So how do we know a good idea is really a good idea for First Nations children and families? Or that that good idea actually works in the diverse and distinct First Nations communities all over this country? Let's dig a little deeper and chat with experts in the field of child well-being about what the evidence says, what are some of the myths, and what works when it comes to supporting First Nations children, young people, and their families. You're listening to Season 2 of Spirit Bearers Ask an Expert podcast. So Spirit Bear and I are really excited today because we get to interview one of the lawyers who has been part of the Canadian human rights case the longest representing the Caring Society. And we know that because she has not one but two bears with her. I'm talking, of course, about the amazing Sarah Clark from Clark Child and Family Law. And we are just so delighted, Sarah, that you're joining us today and that I get to ask you the questions. Now it's kind of a bit of a role reversal. So I wanted to just begin by giving you a moment to describe how you became involved in this case and what was the discrimination that the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal was tackling.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me here today, Cindy. And I didn't know I was going to be cross-examined by you today before I agreed to this, but I'm actually very excited to talk about the case today. And I'm really excited that you're raising these important questions. So first of all, how I got involved in the case is I was doing my master's of social work at Carleton University before I went to law school and did not really know anything about residential schools or the 60 scoop. And I took a course about what was happening in Canada in the 1960s and 70s and learned about the 60s scoop and became very concerned that what I was seeing in the literature that we were following through the course was actually continuing into the modern day. And so my professor introduced me to you and suggested that I do my policy placement with the Caring Society. And that's how we first met. I was actually in second year law school in 2007 when the case first began. And I remember calling you on a payphone from the student lounge of the basement of Windsor Law School when you had announced that the case had begun. And that was really how I became involved. And what we saw throughout the Canadian human rights case was well documented, well understood, and well-costed discrimination at the level of the child. And I have to say, as a Canadian, I don't think I was really prepared for that. I think my initial assessment of the complaint was once Canada really understood how the costing and the structuring of the funding was impacting children, that they would immediately flip the switch and right the wrongs that they were causing. But it became clear quite quickly in the case that actually they were aware that it was causing this level of discrimination and this level of harm, but they were choosing to put money ahead of the rights of children and their families.
Yeah, and what you're describing, Sarah, is something that many people feel. In fact, I felt that back in the early 2000s when we were writing these reports. We thought, we're going to show the federal government that, by the way, for listeners, the federal government funds services for First Nations children and families on reserve and in the Yukon, whereas the provinces do to others. And the inequities were so dramatic in the wake of residential schools, you had to believe that any moral and reasonable person, let alone a government that is a bastion of human rights, when they saw that they were so dramatically underfunding these kids and driving them into child welfare care at higher rates than residential schools and denying kids public services in ways that would create lifelong deficits for them and including, sadly, the passing away of some children, that they would do the right thing. But that is not the case. That is how systemic racism kind of manifests in society, right? And being awakened to that is really disturbing for many Canadians that think that everybody gets the same public services and, in fact, that First Nations folks get more. So the case gets filed by the Assembly of First Nations and the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. And what were some of the big responses that you saw legally from the government of Canada? How did they manage this? They had the evidence that what they were doing was wrong.
Well, certainly I was not prepared for the level of resistance to even have the case heard on its merits. So for about the first 5 years of the case, at every turn, at every opportunity, what the federal government did was bring motions or make jurisdictional arguments that the complaint should not be heard as of right. And so even in the very early days, they were writing to the commission or the Human Rights Tribunal to say, you know what, this complaint isn't really properly brought before this tribunal. We are not really a service provider, which is required under the Canadian Human Rights Act. And I think the most egregious early resistance to the complaint was this idea that they could not possibly be responsible for discrimination against First Nations children because non-First Nations children are funded by the provinces and the territories. And that meant, according to the federal government, that you could not compare what was happening to First Nations children with what was happening to non-First Nations children because the federal government had no control over how non-First Nations children were supported through their government programs, whether that be child welfare or other social service programs. And this level of technical argument, in my view, really stripped at what we were trying to do. It was almost as though they were asking Canadians to look away from the harm that they were very well documenting and really just look at the black and white letter of the law. They really were convinced that in order to apply a formulaic approach to discrimination, you had to be able to compare who was doing what to whom, when, where, and how. And I think one of the reasons that we were successful in this case is that the court took a very justice-seeking ethic approach to the human rights complaint and looked at this from the level of the child and said, it's all about what you know and when you know it. And Canada, you knew and you know what is happening. And so you have control over that. And ultimately, we were able to erase all of those jurisdictional arguments and finally get the tribunal to actually listen to the evidence starting really in 2012. So that's how long it took to actually get this back on the rails.
You know, it sounds like a totally inhumane approach. Like, how can powerful adults ignore what is happening to children and families on the ground, especially after what they did to them in residential schools, and really come up with these legal loophole arguments to defend themselves? They're kind of making themselves the victims, weren't they?
They were. And I think that speaks to the fact that you even had to bring the complaint in the first place. I mean, when we look at the evidence in this case, and what I say, especially when I teach this class at various talks or schools that I go to, what I say about this case that is so amazing is that Canada actually had the most profound evidence itself of the discrimination that it was causing. This was not a case where we had to go out and retain separate expert litigation support to make the case. The evidence was well within the four corners of the federal government. They partnered with agencies like the Assembly of First Nations and the Caring Society on research projects. Lots of research was provided to them on an ongoing basis. And then, of course, the Auditor General herself, Sheila Fraser, did an excellent report and a follow-up report on how the costing was directly impacting children and their families. So to me, you know, as a litigator, sometimes that's what you worry about is what's the evidence going to be and how are you going to apply that evidence to the law? That was never an issue in this case. The evidence was just so profound on how they were hurting kids and families and how they were actually tracking it and documenting it.
And the case goes to trial in 2013, and we're in 3 months into this trial. It was 72 days long. People sometimes forget. And we found that Canada was withholding some of those documents that were the most prejudicial to their argument. Over that 72 days, what is the moment that kind of stands out to you?
For me, it was really having the kids in the room. I think I've never been a part of a case before this and after, where children are actually in the room listening and watching and making decisions for themselves and passing judgment about what they're hearing. I think that really was the most profound part for me because it made us all sit up a little taller, I think, and be very careful about how we were explaining our various parties' positions. And I think that was really profound. I think it did have an impact on the case. I think there's a very, very exciting space for research to actually be done on this. Because as you know, Cindy, I practice mostly in child protection. And it's very rare to have children in the courtroom unless they are over a certain age or, and are at a certain level at the part where we're making decisions. And I think it had a really positive impact on the case. And they continue to be around, right? The kids continue to be around the case and talk about the case. My own children are severely, not in a negative way, but are profoundly impacted by this case. So I think that has been the magic of this case, is to have children watching and listening.
Yeah, that was my favorite part, too. And everyone, you can watch The Children in a Courtroom by going to the National Film Board and checking out the amazing Ellen Nisobomsawin's documentary about this case, We Can't Make the Same Mistake Twice. The ruling finally comes out in 2016, and I remember the government paraded out a bunch of ministers. They welcomed the decision, and you'll probably remember it was just a few weeks before that that the TRC actually issued its final report and put child welfare and Jordan's principle, the two main pieces of our case, as top calls to action. Government adopted those. What was your thinking about what government would do with this new ruling? Were you expecting them to follow it?
So first, I want to say that the ruling, I think, has profoundly shaped the human rights lens. The tribunal, I think, transformed what we understand to be substantive equality. So I think we cannot lose sight of the fact from as the lawyer in the podcast today, you know, I really just want folks who care about the law and who are dedicated to working in a human rights context, even if you don't work in this area, to really take a look at that ruling 2016 CHRT 2. The way the tribunal describes how substantive equality is both a remedy and a shield. You know, we are entitled to substantive equality and we can use it to change the way that we deliver service to children and families is amazing. And as Anne Levesque would call it, really what they did was they gave us transformative equality, a standard of equity that I think children can describe, but adults have a hard time articulating. It really is amazing. And I remember when the ruling came out, and I remember watching the press, and I remember thinking, oh, we have arrived. This has not been, you know, years and years of litigation for nothing. It's taken so long, you know, it had taken so long to get to receiving the ruling, even between the time that we finished our closing submissions in October of 2014 and receiving the ruling in 2016. That was a long wait, as one of the members had passed away. And so that sort of delayed the release of the decision. So there was so much excitement when it came. And to watch the government really wrap its arms around the ruling, I thought was a very good sign. But quite quickly, actually, it became clear that they were really treating the decision almost as window dressing. That they were saying that they accepted the ruling, they did not seek judicial review of the decision, but then they did not spring to action, even though the tribunal was very clear, you must take immediate measures to remediate the discrimination, both with respect to Jordan's principle and with respect to child and family services. And the tribunal set out a pathway on how they could do that. And almost immediately it became clear that they were not going to take action on their own. And that was really disappointing. And to me, I must say, quite surprising. I really believed that this was the ammunition that they needed internally to take action. And that's not what happened.
Yeah, we've now had, I think, 23 non-compliance and procedural orders. That ruling, by the way, came out in January 26, 2016. So it was already 7 years ago. And we're still in court. This case, Sarah, will be 17 years old on February 23rd of this year. It would be in grade 12 if it was a child. And this is the tragedy of it, is Canada tries to worm its way out of accountability for this discrimination. There's children growing up and they only get one childhood. That's the thing, right? This procedural wrangling in the courts actually does have consequences, real life consequences for kids. And in fact, I think it was, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was 2019, the tribunal actually links Canada's noncompliance to the deaths of 3 12-year-old little girls. And that can't be lost on the public. Now, one of the things that the tribunal puts in that order that you're talking about, which starts, by the way, the first sentence of it, I remember reading it, is this case is about children. And it really, I think that that is the big thing they ingrain in the law, is they center these kids at every opportunity and every one of these rulings that's come out by the tribunal and then later by the federal court. But they have two kind of goals. One is, Canada, you got to stop discriminating. no more, you know, public relations stuff and then hurting kids. You got to stop that. Second is you got to make sure you don't do this again. Like, let's keep in mind, this government has done the residential schools, the 60 scoop that you learned about in university, and now the discrimination against these kids. Now, there's something called long-term reform. I actually don't like that word because I think it makes it sound kind of benign. What we're really trying to do is stop the discrimination and make sure it doesn't happen again. And there was a big landmark decision from the federal court, and the folks in orange shirts in the wake of Kamloops that really pressured the government to begin a negotiation process to try and end this case. Can you explain to us what's happened since November of 2021 when this process started and what people should be looking for in the months ahead?
Certainly. So what's happening right now is the parties are talking to each other about how to achieve the milestones and the principles and the hallmarks and all the different things that the tribunal has told us to do. The tribunal has been very clear that in order for this case to be properly resolved, we have to make sure, and the tribunal has to be satisfied on an evidentiary basis, that not only has the immediate discrimination stopped, but that the broader systemic and insidious discrimination that's ingrained throughout the bureaucracy of the government is stopped, and that there are adequate and evidence-informed safeguards to prevent it from occurring, just as you described. So that means everything from how child and family services are funded, how are First Nations receiving support to deliver programs to protect their children? How are families accessing Jordan's principle? How is the government responding to those requests? How are concerns being mitigated as the processes on both sides of CFS and Jordan's principle dealt with? And how can we reform the department? So these are all the main topics that the tribunal has set out for us that the parties are talking about. And you know, we are working towards doing what the tribunal has asked us. And it's a huge task. You know, I explain sometimes, you know, in the normal course of a settlement, you might have one issue that you're talking about. You might have one issue you try to fix. You know, class action water comes to example, right? You're talking about one item, which is clean drinking water. In our case, we are really looking at a broad spectrum of services and government delivery systems that impact First Nations kids across the country. So we're not, jurisdictionally, we're not confined to one province or territory. We're spread out across the country, and we have to take all of those regional variations into consideration as well. So it is a really big job. And if people think to themselves, wow, since November 2021, you're still not done. Well, one of the reasons we're not done is because it's a really big job. And I think we can't lose sight of the fact that the discrimination was so deeply rooted within the government that we have to make sure we get around every corner and every nook and cranny to get rid of it in order for the tribunal to be satisfied that it can actually close the complaint and be satisfied that kids are going to be protected in the futures to come.
Now, some of our listeners might have heard the government announces $19.8 billion over 5 years. And say, well, you know, isn't it fixed by the $19.8 billion over 5 years? That's a lot of money. What do you have to say about that?
I don't think generally that any party would sneeze at $19.08 billion. It's a lot of money, particularly when you think back to when the complaint was filed, that I think the problem that was identified in the late 1990s could have been remediated by an additional $138 million. I can't remember the exact figures, Cindy, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but it was not $19.08 billion. So it is a lot of money. However, it's not the money that is going to fix this problem. It's about the structure. It's about the structure of how services and programming are delivered. And what the tribunal has been very clear about throughout every single one of its decisions. And interestingly, so people understand, the tribunal has never ordered a dollar amount. They have never said, this is the money that you need to fix the problem. What they've always identified is the structure that needs to change to meet the needs of kids. That's the standard that we have to go against within the human rights context. These children are entitled to have their needs met so that they can live the lives that they're entitled to live under the Canadian Human Rights Act. And so, yes, we need money to assist and make sure that we are addressing some of the financial pitfalls within the system. But that money doesn't really matter if the structure itself is not there to respond to the needs of kids and their families, and to do it in a way that's evidence-informed and do it in a way that respects the diversity of First Nations across the country. So it's a really big job. And that's why it's not as simple as Canada just writing a check. We have to be engaged with what the tribunal has set out before us to do.
What happens in year six with this $19.8 billion? It's over 5 years. So if we wrap it up now, like some people might say, well, look, this is a big win for kids. Why don't you just pack it up? What happens in year six?
Well, I think we have to be very mindful of what the tribunal has said. The tribunal has not given the parties a five-year runway. What they have told us to do is to make sure that the discrimination is over and prevent its recurrence, period. It has said that in almost every single one of its decisions, whether it be 23 or 27 now. There are so many decisions that have been released since 2016. It's hard to keep count. But they've been very clear that their expectation is that we will be taking this responsibility very seriously and ensuring that the discrimination is not going to recur over the next forever, as far as I'm concerned. They have not placed a time limit on it. So, you know, the parties may agree to this sort of approach. We have to be mindful that the tribunal has been very clear about what its expectations are. And, you know, legally speaking, there's nowhere in the decision that I can see that the tribunal has put a cap on the number of years to fix the problem.
Yeah, it has to be a forever solution, right? We didn't just do this for non-discrimination for 5 years. And just to let listeners know, Canada hasn't provided all that money, the $19.8 billion. About 25% of it is still holding back. And so that needs to get out the door for kids. And the rest of it has been actually because of Canadian Human Rights Tribunal orders to remedy the discrimination. Sarah, we're going to have a conversation at some point with Lena Gaspard and the folks over at IFSD. But one of the things we've really been trying to do is make sure that we're really basing it on the needs of kids. And the best way to do that is getting out there and talking to communities and making sure that their voices are heard in this long-term solution and that that's actually embedded in there. So it's not just writing stuff on the back of a napkin for First Nations kids. It's actually doing the hard work of making sure that things get right. Now, we're just going to wrap up on this piece. We don't know when the tribunal will end its jurisdiction right now. I think I've publicly said that I don't think it's time. I think that there's still a lot of stuff that the government is doing that is problematic and discriminatory and needs to stop. And we don't have adequate safeguards to protect kids going on for the future. If you had three key messages you want people to know about how this case has changed the lives of First Nations children and the country, what would you say?
I think, first of all, I hope that on the ground, kids feel like they're being heard, that their needs are important and that they are entitled to substantive equality. And I think what's been really challenging to watch throughout the case is really how dehumanizing, you know, Excel spreadsheets and graphs and money that the government tracks was never really about the human experience of children. And I hope that kids feel like we were listening to them, that all of the, you know, AFN, Chiefs of Ontario, Anishinaabe, Aski Nation were bringing their stories forward in a meaningful way so that the tribunal and the rest of the country could actually really understand what was happening. So I hope that they feel heard by us and by the tribunal, which is a very important entity within our Canadian society, within our democracy, and, you know, within the rule of law, that they are entitled to substantive equality. I also think that as a non-Indigenous person, I think the case has had a profound effect on all Canadians, whether you're Indigenous or not. I think this case is now in the minds of all Canadians. They know what we're talking about, when we're talking about it, and they have some insight into the unfairness and the injustice that has been perpetrated by the federal government. So I think that that's really important. I think the third thing that the case has done is really disrupted this idea that good enough is justice, or that we tried our best, and that's justice. Trying your best and doing what you can within the four corners of your job within any government entity might be okay in your day-to-day, but that is not what substantive equality looks like on the ground. And the government was not able to convince the tribunal or the federal court or the Federal Court of Appeal or any entity that we've been before that trying their best was enough for kids. The adults in the room have to stop thinking that way and look at the impact of their decisions or their decisions to do nothing, as you've talked about before. And for those who don't, it means that there can be a different way of doing things. And so while this case is generally focused on child and family services and Jordan's principle, I do think it's going to have a profound impact on all of the other cases that are coming behind us on issues that impact not just First Nations children, but all children within Canadian society, that they have rights as children to have their needs met in a way that promotes and protects their rights to substantive equality.
You know, Sarah, one of the things that I always find fascinating is the government will call everything to do with First Nations children's equity as complex. And yet they're delivering that equality to all other kids in the country without question. Same with getting clean drinking water out to First Nations community. That's somehow complex, but they can get it to the space station. It really is a mindset by the government that when they choose to hurt and discriminate against First Nations children. And too often still, we're hearing, please be grateful to us. This is us acting in reconciliation versus having to continually drag them to court. And we're going to talk about two active appeals that the government has in our next episode, Sarah. I want to just use this moment, though, to thank you publicly for all of the great dedication and work that you and your family have given to First Nations children. And we're forever grateful to you and your colleagues, David Taylor and Anne Levesque and more. Thank you so much for joining us. Just one last word from you, Sarah. What has it meant for you to be a part of this case?
Oh, it's changed my life. I don't think there's any other way to put it. Going to law school was a really big decision for me, as you know. I really had my heart in social work, but I think my loud mouth and wanting to be an instrument for good dragged me into the law, kicking and screaming. But I think this case has shaped my career. It's given me the ability to really share my passion for children's rights, which was a hard thing to place in law school. Where do you sort of put that energy? And it's really opened doors for me to work directly with First Nation communities also who are supporting their children at the very basic level of delivering child and family services. So, I mean, it's changed my life. It's changed the direction of our family. I think my children have learned so much more about just basic human rights for children because of this case. If we weren't a part of it, it would, you know, not really be, I think, something that they would know as much about. So I want to thank you, Cindy, for always bringing me in and trusting me. And it's really been a wild ride. And I continue to be surprised sometimes by the level of resistance and discrimination that we're seeing. But we really now have the tools to actually get at the heart of this. And that gives me great hope. And I think Canadians are with us. So this has been a wonderful experience, and we're going to have to just keep working.
We are. And children's lives are changing for the better, particularly through Jordan's principle and for the good work of First Nations child and family service agencies and other providers in keeping families together. Folks, if you want to learn more about this landmark case, go to fnwitness.ca. Or as always, you can follow at Spirit Bear on social media. Spirit Bear has been at all this litigation, and he's guaranteed that he's not going to retire until the case is over. So until next time, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Spirit Bear's Ask an Expert podcast. Be sure to tune in for more episodes coming up where we'll do this all again and find out what works for kids. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at Caring Society or visit our website, fncaringsociety.com, where you can get all kinds of information about this topic and our future episodes.